Will the FCC, under President Trump, allow its media ally, the Sinclair Broadcast Group, to merge with Tribune Media so as to create the largest broadcast company in history? Chris Terry watches the FCC very closely, and what he has seen so far indicates that the FCC is bending over backwards for Sinclair.
They're really trying to get around their own rules here to put this deal through. There's very little other explanation for why the FCC acted the way it did.
As of now, Sinclair Group covers about 38% of U.S. homes, and they're seeking a merger to double that amount, which only matters if you care about local TV news. And that's just something that really old people watch, right?
Yes, it's people 50 and above disproportionately, but people 50 and above disproportionately vote.
That's Louis Friedland, director of the Center for Communication and Democracy.
So if you care about, even in the short run, about winning elections, if you're progressive, then you should care a lot about what local news does.
Local news, Sinclair merging with Tribune, the FCC under President Trump, it's all ahead. On Radio Survivors Today, Paul Reese-Mandel interviews Louis A. Friedland, professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and frequent Radio Survivor guest Christopher Terry, assistant professor of media law at the University of Minnesota Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication. My name is Eric Klein. Thanks for tuning into Radio Survivor, the sound of strong communities. It's tempting to frame this Sinclair merger story in a Trump-only context. The corporation's strong political bias is well documented, but the story of media consolidation is too rich and complex for that kind of oversimplification. You could start the tale of Sinclair and its ambitions to grow to be the biggest, baddest local TV station owner in all sorts of places, including the mega media merger of NBC and Comcast, which took place under the watch of President Obama's FCC.
When Comcast and NBC merged, one of the arguments against Comcast and NBC merging was you were going to have to allow other mergers so that competition could continue. If you allow Sinclair to absorb all these stations, they're going to be at almost double the legal limit for broadcast television station ownership on a national level. The only way you're going to be able to create a company that can compete with them in that environment is to create more companies with this kind of scale.
Again, Lou Friedland.
The greater danger is just to have one company that's this concentrated.
Friedland points out that there are hardly enough local stations left to consolidate into competition for Sinclair if this merger goes through. It's already big.
You can't have that many giant broadcast groups because there aren't that many local television stations. So what you're doing is you're opening the door. Comcast, NBC really opened the door, but Sinclair is a huge giant step forward through it, where you've got essentially opening the door to local media oligopoly in the United States.
Opening the door to local media oligopoly. I think we have the title for this week's episode. Speaking of titles, swift boating. The word is an unfair or untrue political attack, and it was coined in 2004 when John Kerry, the Democratic nominee running against President George W. Bush, was swift boated by a piece of political propaganda that was passed off as news by the Sinclair stations. Again, Christopher Terry.
Back in 2004, Sinclair was the organization that was pushing the Stolen Honor documentary that attacked John Kerry. I mean, Sinclair's viewpoint is well known. But from my perspective, I understand the objection to Sinclair's viewpoint. But for me, it's a regulation issue, right? It wouldn't matter if it was Happy Tree Huggers Incorporated that was trying to push this. The scale of this merger is far too big. It's very anti-competitive, and it undermines many of the existing rules on media ownership, which protect things like local content.
So if you've heard anything about this Sinclair merger story, you've either been listening to Radio Survivor, or you saw coverage of an incredible supercut produced by Deadspin, a supercut of news anchors from around the country reading the exact same script, a script best described as Orwellian meets Trumpian, a fake news commentary on the dangers of fake news. This must run, as they say, turned internet meme, could be seen as a heavy-handed push from the Sinclair company to curry favor with the Trump administration to get the merger through. But as Paul Reese-Mandel posits in today's episode, like, why would they make such a dumb blunder to call attention to themselves when the deal is already, you know, is being pushed in their favor already. So why would they push even harder? Well, Christopher Terry has a theory.
They're doing everything they can to push this deal through because we haven't talked about one of the really important aspects of this deal. And that's how much power Sinclair ends up with over political advertising sales in this country after this deal is done. Mm-hmm. That is something that you don't hear a lot of people talking about. But if you're an outside group, even a major political party, and you're going to want to do business going into the midterms, but also the 2020 election, you're going to have to do business with Sinclair.
So that's just a little bit of a taste of what's to come on today's episode of Radio Survivor, brought to you today by your host, Paul Rees-Mandel.
Joining me on the line from Madison, Wisconsin, is Professor Lou Friedland. He's a professor of journalism and mass communication and director of the Center for Communication Democracy at the University of Wisconsin. And our old friend, Professor Christopher Terry, is joining us from the great state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota, where he is a professor of journalism and media law. Thank you both for joining us here on Radio Survivor. We're going to try and get a little deeper into Sinclair and the Tribune merger that is something they would like to execute, as well as the Tribune Company would like to execute, and really try to understand why people oppose this and what are some of the implications for our media environment and, to that extent, for our democracy. So, Lou, can you kind of give us a quick summary of why Sinclair now has gone from something which just media nerds and ownership nerds are talking about to something which is now turning up on your local, on NBC Nightly News and turning up in the pages of the New York Times?
Sure. It's funny that Sinclair is the largest television group in the United States, and even people who pay attention to these things, I don't think really know that, or certainly didn't know that until maybe a few months ago. It owns 173 stations right now. It reaches about 38% of the American people. And so for that reason alone, we ought to at least know who they are. But the reason that I think they've been inching into public attention, I wouldn't say exploding, I wish, is because of the the main reason they exploded into public attention is because about a little over a month ago, they required all of their anchors to read a statement on the air simultaneously. The statement was written out of their Maryland headquarters by their vice president of news, and it was essentially a supporting of the president's notion of fake news and saying that Sinclair was not fake news. And they wanted to hear from their viewers if people thought that they were. So BuzzFeed put together a compilation of this, and which I urge all of your listeners to go check out if they haven't. It's quite remarkable. And so what you see is these anchors in a way that smacks of propaganda. I can't think of any other possible word for it. All reading the same thing at the same time, basically accusing the other media in the United States of engaging in unreliable fake news. So effectively, they join President Trump's attack on the news media as a whole. Now, this would be significant enough, but they have applied to the FCC, before the FCC, to expand their group from the 173 that they have now to acquire the Tribune Media Corporation, the television stations, I should say, the Tribune Company, and they'd pay about $3.9 billion and get 42 additional stations, which would raise them to 215 total. Now, that's significant because, as I said before, right now they cover 38% of American homes. That would raise them to cover 71% of all homes in the U.S. So they would almost double their reach, and not only become the largest by a factor of, you know, two, but they would be essentially an arm of the Trump administration in many ways. And we've never seen this before in the United States. It's a completely new phenomenon. There's plenty of things that you can say, critical, legitimate things that one could say about local news. Sometimes it doesn't pay enough attention to politics or local government. In fact, often it doesn't. But it hasn't been, at least up to now, a propaganda arm for any administration. So this is really a troubling new development.
Why hasn't this sort of thing happened before? I mean, it seems to me that with the kind of agglomerated, consolidated power that many broadcast companies like Sinclair have gathered in the years since the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the television stations and radio stations, of course, are ripe for use for this sort of thing because, as I understand correctly, I mean, there is no federal statute of any sort. There's no FCC regulation that prevents an owner for using these stations to broadcast a definitive political position. Is that correct? So why hasn't this happened?
Well, I think it hasn't happened up to now for a number of reasons. You mentioned radio, and I know that's one of the primary focus of your podcast. I mean, in some ways we could say it has happened in radio, just not in a single source consolidated way. If you look at, you know, local radio, certainly local radio beyond music in the United States, a large portion of AM radio has been effectively turned over to conservative propaganda or conservative talk show hosts or ultra-conservative talk show hosts, ranging from Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity to Levin and even Alex Jones. So, I mean, truly right-wing propaganda coming out over the airwaves. In Wisconsin, we have a total, and this is cumulative across all of our cities, of 73 hours a day of right-wing talk radio happening. And so it saturates the rural areas of our country where people still listen to AM radio. It's often to the right even of Fox News. So in radio, I think we could say it has happened, but and I want to be really clear about this, not one single group controlling a number of stations and then essentially flipping the switch in this way. And why hasn't it happened? I think it hasn't happened for a number of reasons, in television especially. For one thing, I think that you know, most people don't really want this kind of news coming at them. And that's for good and bad reasons that we can get into if you want. I think most people, when they settle down for the 6 o'clock or the 10 o'clock news or their morning news show, they don't want to see, they don't want to see their local anchors that they, if they don't love them, at least they recognize them and maybe trust them. They don't want to see them effectively giving them, right-wing editorials on a daily, nightly basis, which most Sinclair stations do. This is even before the, before the mandated opinion piece. They have Boris Epstein on three times a week, who was a former member of the Trump campaign, offering editorials on a regular basis. Their own VP of news does that on a regular basis. So even beyond this recent event, they essentially have become that kind of propaganda organization. And I think the thing about it is that most local television is very competitive. People on the progressives, people on the left recognize that there's concentration and there's a lot to criticize, but it's also a very competitive business. And people, for the most part, I think don't want to see this stuff on a nightly basis. And I think that really constrains your average station owner, your average station group from mobilizing this way. And I'll be honest with you, and again, I know this cuts against some of the grain of certain kinds of thinking, but I don't think that television station owners as a whole, some certainly are conservative, some are even ultra conservative, but most of them just want to make money.
Certainly. So a question I have, I'm not somebody who really watches a lot of local broadcast television or broadcast television news. I think a lot of people at this time mostly associate with this as something which appeals to an older generation. So I wonder, why are people upset if you know, it seems as though local television is a declining commodity. Why should folks who don't watch local television news, why should they care?
Well, it's not a declining commodity. I think sometimes younger folks believe that it is for all kinds of good reasons. They spend, you know, spend your times online. But approximately these numbers fluctuate and they're declining, but 50% of Americans still get their significant amount of news from television in general, and 37% from local news. So, yes, it's proportionally older people, but local news is really an important part of the local communication environment. As I think we've seen in the protests in the past, well, certainly year, more and more people are turning to their localities. They realize that, hey, my city is important, my county is important, my state representative is important. Things are happening here. These are places where I can get active and engage in democracy. Well, if most people locally get their news from local television, which in fact often then cribs it from the local newspaper, that's a separate discussion. But people see it on TV. That's where they majority experience local news. Then it really shapes their sense of their local environment. You know, when people are pursuing all kinds of initiatives locally now, everything from minimum wage initiatives at the city level to global warming or climate change initiatives at the local level, what happens in local communities really matters. And furthermore, yes, it's people 50 and above disproportionately, but people 50 and above disproportionately vote. Mm-hmm. So if you care about, even in the short run, about winning elections, if you're progressive, then you should care a lot about what local news does.
So, Chris Terry, you know, folks have been a little bit woken up now to Sinclair, the company, its market power, its national media power, through hearing about the statements which local affiliates have been ordered to read on their local newscasts. That's causing people now to think about this Tribune-Sinclair merger. Is this a factor when it comes to reviewing this merger? I know you and I have talked on the show about how it seems as though FCC Chairman Pai is bending over backwards to allow this merger to happen. But, you know, does this complicate things for Chairman Pai? Or does it possibly make the merger something which would require a review by the Justice Department? Does this complicate things? Or are we still talking about kind of a fundamental sort of market power argument, regardless of whatever the message is?
Well, I don't think that Pai necessarily cares about Sinclair's viewpoint. He's certainly in favor of many of the things that Sinclair pushes. But I don't think the viewpoint is the real issue here. It's sort of taken center stage in our discussion of the potential merger. But what really matters in this merger is the scale of it. When Comcast and NBC merged, one of the arguments against Comcast and NBC merging was you were going to have to allow other mergers so that competition could continue. If you allow Sinclair to absorb all these stations, they're going to be at almost double the legal limit for broadcast television station ownership on a national level. The only way you're going to be able to create a company that can compete with them in that environment is to create more companies with this kind of scale. And I do think that the attention being paid to Sinclair here certainly complicates the passage of this. But I don't think it fundamentally alters the basic argument that the FCC is trying to put together a deal that the law does not allow it to pass.
And Professor Friedland, thinking about that kind of market power, imagining that Sinclair had not mandated that its anchors, its news anchors, read this statement, why would you oppose this merger here? I mean, you certainly, that sounded the way you were going and sort of articulating the market power that will accumulate all the way to 71% of American homes would be served by the combined Sinclair Tribune stations. Why would that sort of market power be dangerous to democracy, I suppose?
Well, that's a great question. And I think we do have a history in this country, and we have a history in doctrine. So there's a difference between broadcast policy, broadcast doctrine, and broadcast law. And as Chris said a few moments ago, there are elements of this specific merger that I think are, frankly, illegal in the sense of not following correct administrative procedure. And we can get into those weeds if you want to. But also, as Chris said, the greater danger is just to have one company. It's this concentrator. And I think he made a great point when he said Comcast, NBC, the justification was, well, you know, they need this to compete. And so once you've opened that door, then who doesn't need it to compete? But of course, you can't have that many giant broadcast groups because there aren't that many local television stations. So what you're doing is you're opening the door. And again, as Chris said, Comcast, NBC really opened the door, but Sinclair is a huge giant step forward through it, where you've got essentially opening the door to several local media local media oligopoly in the United States, in which how many, three, four, who knows precisely, large groups will essentially dominate the opinion space. And again, if Sinclair is a great example, if this merger goes through and they have 71%, other groups will say, hey, we should be able to have 70%. 38% is the limit right now. The maximum, I should say, 39% is of the American people. Stations, one group can only own stations reaching 39% of the American people. And through essentially a sleight of hand, a series of special Sinclair rules, Commissioner Pai has reinstituted a UHF rule that has no application in this situation at all, which would allow that to double. And so there are procedural irregularities. I think it's anti-democratic. It's not the way we should be making law and policy. We shouldn't be making law and policy to benefit one single corporation. And furthermore, the actual growth of Sinclair to this size would threaten oligopoly across the United States in local news.
And I'm speaking with Professor Lou Friedland from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's a professor of journalism there. We're also speaking to Professor Christopher Terry from the University of Minnesota. This is Radio Survivor. My name is Paul Reese-Mandel, and this is The Sound of Strong Communities. And we're talking about Sinclair Communication, its proposed merger with Tribune and taking on Tribune Company's television stations to potentially control 71%, to reach 71% of the American television households, an unprecedented number that's never happened before. And also kind of uncovering, you know, and kind of pulling apart how Sinclair's now hit the mainstream news, how people have heard the name when maybe they'd never heard of Sinclair before, and teasing out all these different tendrils here. So Professor Terry, you know, something which Lou alluded to and something which we've talked a little bit about before on the program is all the ways in which it appears that Chairman Pai of the FCC is trying to kind of shoehorn in an approval for Sinclair to take over Tribune TV stations, to reach 71% of American households when 39% is otherwise the established limit. Can you give us that quick kind of like rundown of what what mechanisms he's trying to do? What are the rules he's trying to bend? Lou mentioned this UHF discount, right, which used to exist but doesn't any longer. Can you kind of explain that quickly?
Sure. The UHF discount goes back to analog television stations that were above 13 on that old dial-y telephone or dial-y television that you had were in a different area of the spectrum that was far less stable. So in counting those stations, the FCC treated stations in the UHF band, channels 14 to 74, as half of a station. When we went to digital, lots of stations migrated to the UHF band, and the discount went away.
And why was there a discount? Why would you get a discount for being on channel 15 as opposed to channel 11?
Well, the UHF signal, the ultra high frequency area of the spectrum back in the analog television days, was far less stable. But more importantly, those were usually the additional stations. They weren't necessarily network affiliates. they tended to be locally operated independent stations. And as such, they were never generators for quite as much money as something in the 2 to 12 range would have been in the old analog days. Nowadays, though, the UHF discount is what the commission is trying to re-implement. Most of the digital television stations are actually in the UHF band now, but they're digital so that they actually have a far more stable signal they did back in the analog technology. But the 39% rule is really, really stymieing them, mostly because that rule didn't come from the commission, but was actually handed to the commission by Congress directly.
I see. So this is law. This is not something which the FCC's five commissioners could vote to change just like that.
In fact, even one of the conservatives, Commissioner O'Reilly, disagrees that the agency can change the 39% rule. And that's important, and that's part of the reason the UHF discount is one of the techniques that's being put in. But even if the FCC could get around the 39% discount, the agency handed down media ownership rules, which I've been on to talk about quite a few times on here on Radio Survivor in the past, back in November of last year. And those changed, among other things, the local television rule, the top two provision, which doesn't allow a single provider to have the top two rated or two of the top four rated stations in any particular market. There were some changes to how local ownership was considered, and also rules that changed the joint service agreements, which are agreements where I own a station, but I lease it out to you to run it for me, and we kind of share the profits. All of those rules were changed, and it looks like, and arguably so, those rules were passed or handed down from the FCC under PI, all in order to shepherd through this deal. And that's problematic because they're really trying to get around their own rules here to put this deal through. There's very little other explanation for why the FCC acted the way it did in November of last year.
And it's hard to understand why Chairman Pai in particular would be so pro pushing through this merger. On the one hand, I guess one interpretation would be that he's an absolute so-called free market anti-regulation true believer of such a sort that he just wants to mow down every possible ownership regulation. But I can also see why somebody watching this would say, well, wait a second, he's also a Trump appointee in terms of becoming the chairman of the commission. He was appointed before that and served on the commission under President Obama. But it is President Trump who appointed him as chairman, and he's taken on a sort of one might call Trumpian style in his chairmanship, being brash and outspoken and in a way that we haven't really seen FCC chairman do in the past. It's hard not to imagine that Sinclair's ideological bearings don't factor into Chairman Pai's enthusiasm to ram through this kind of rule change. I mean, do you see these parallels, Chris, or do you think that this is sort of more of a happy accident?
No, I think you're assuming those two things are potentially mutually exclusive. He can be a total free marketer, but also be very in favor of the kind of positions that Sinclair has taken. Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about this more recent debate about Sinclair and their viewpoint is that anyone who's paid attention to these things for a long time knows that this isn't a new thing for Sinclair. Back in 2004, Sinclair was the organization that was pushing the Stolen Honor documentary that attacked John Kerry. I mean, Sinclair's viewpoint is well known. But from my perspective, I understand the objection to Sinclair's viewpoint, but for me, it's a regulation issue, right? It wouldn't matter if it was Happy Tree Huggers Incorporated that was trying to push this. The scale of this merger is far too big. It's very anti-competitive, and it undermines many of the existing rules on media ownership, which protect things like local content. I don't think Sinclair's viewpoint is the issue here. For me, the issue is far more about what the FCC is trying to do to pass this deal.
Go ahead, please, Lou.
I just want to jump in. I agree with everything that Chris just said. Well, actually, I want to slightly raise a. I think it's both. I think that the anti-competitive merger questions and the, frankly, the abrogation of normal rulemaking processes are themselves anti-democratic and would be wrong, as Chris said, regardless of the ideological viewpoint. But I do think that when you have a station that has such a strong, clear ideological viewpoint like this, it does mitigate against the doctrine of localism, which is a clear and still important part of American and broadcast doctrine. There was a study done recently by two professors at Emory University that showed that, lo and behold, at Sinclair stations, local national news increases, must carries and public relations type PR video news releases dominate, and local news gets crowded out. So there is an effect, not just an ideological effect, but an effect on the actual amount of local news that Sinclair produces. And I think that's not wholly unrelated to their ideological mission. I also think, and this is, a parsimonious, a question of parsimonious explanation. I think that Ajit Pai certainly is a conservative, and he's certainly aligned with President Trump. And he met with Sinclair the day before Trump was inaugurated. All of his regulations, all of his major regulatory initiatives to date have essentially been for Sinclair for all intents and purposes. So, the simple explanation might be that he's looking for a job when he gets done at the FCC.
The revolving door in Washington, right, between the industry you regulate and being in the regulator.
Exactly. And Pai comes from Verizon. He's played this game before. So, this is just the latest gravy train to jump on. Now, of course, I don't know that. I want to be really clear. I don't know that. But the circumstances make it appear as if that may be the case. And the Inspector General of the FCC certainly thought there was a sufficient case to be investigating Pai's relationship with Sinclair. So until that Inspector General's report comes out and is done, and frankly, until Congress does its job in investigating whether this massive turnover of stations to one company has been influenced by some other quid pro quo, this deal absolutely should not go through.
It's important to know that what Lou's talking about here, too, there's plenty of precedent for this. During the Comcast-NBC merger, Commissioner Baker was lamenting how long the deal was taking to get approval. And shortly after the deal was approved, she ran and became Comcast's head lobbyist. So the revolving door
just
is
coincidentally, Chris.
Yeah, coincidentally. Right. I want to build on something that Lou was just talking about. One of my objections to Sinclair directly is the model for content production that they use. Less than the content itself, the model of content production that Sinclair proposes to use with this merger is something that does concern me. And that's by nationalizing their content production. Their opinion on what national issues should be is one thing, but it is an issue that their decision to move content production out of local stations and to centralize it, that's something that does need to be discussed. But importantly, I think something that Lou said earlier in the program is incorrect. I think we have seen something on this scale, and that's when we talk about Clear Channel. As many of the listeners know, I used to be a producer for Clear Channel, and I saw the nationalization of local content production be done when I was working as a producer. And it didn't work for Clear Channel, and as I've been quoted in the media as saying, I don't think it works for Sinclair in the long run. But even when Clear Channel was running the table on this, they didn't have nearly the influence that Sinclair will have after this merger. And I think what ultimately happens here is that Sinclair essentially kills local news in its stations for essentially a broadcast version of what you see at the national level on the cable networks. It's essentially not journalism. It's opinion programming that takes the form of sort of a news-like substance. And remember that Sinclair has had problems. Lou brought up the VNR issue. Sinclair is under potentially still looking at a $13 million fine for the use of video news releases without disclosure. So the issues that Lou brings up are there, but they're bigger than just whether or not Sinclair has a right or left point of view, that they're tied to larger issues. That Sinclair is not a good actor is part of this equation.
And those video, those VNRs you bring up are video news releases. So these were, this is a case in which PR firms were basically creating and distributing these packages that look and sound like a news piece on a local station, but were actually paid for by, like, say, a pharmaceutical company talking about new pharmaceutical breakthroughs that just happened to be, you know, sounding very positive about a new pharmaceutical, which the company which sponsored it is putting out. That's the kind of thing which you're talking about. So Lou, I mean, what do you think of this model, you know, clear channelification of local television, right? Where, you know, Clear Channel was infamous for buying up stations and centralizing operations, getting rid of local talent, doing more voice tracking, often with talent that were hundreds or thousands of miles away, taking, you know, sucking out what little localism was left in radio, primarily music radio. What do you think of this potential with Sinclair, which I believe the company has signaled its intentions to nationalize much of its news production? And what does that do to a local community when that happens?
Well, just first of all, let me say, I was saying that this hadn't happened in TV. And I think the example of Clear Channel is an excellent one, an excellent example of what might happen. Although, and I think it's interesting, and Chris did say that it wasn't that successful in many ways. So the question is, you know, when you have this sort of homogenized national production, does it actually appeal to viewers or listeners? And I do think that for Sinclair specifically, it will. Well, we know what it's done. I mean, the study by, just give them credit, Gregory Martin and Josh McCrane, these two Emory political scientists, is the best study that we have of Sinclair, one of the bigger studies we have of local news generally. They looked at 743 local stations over 2017, and they analyzed about 7.5 million transcript segments and compared Sinclair to other stations. And they showed that Sinclair spent about two-thirds of the time on local news that other stations did. So they're already cutting this by almost 50%. Their national political coverage increased overall by 25% in the Sinclair stations. Their coverage became significantly more conservative. And I think that that's essentially creating a local, you know, that will affect the local news environment. And I think another cost potentially to local democratic communication is, you know, local communication really is an ecology. And that's a metaphor that gets thrown around by academics these days. But I think it's a fairly good one, because what happens in one sector affects another. So local newspapers, for example, are the core of most real local reporting. If you want to know what's happening in your local schools, even if you see it online, there's a 90% chance that it came from a local newspaper. And so that's already a problem, because local newspapers are shrinking across the United States, shrinking and consolidating. When you start getting Sinclair stations owning this many stations in this many markets, or Sinclair Group, I should say, what happens then is that you get potentially a cable news environment in miniature in local communities. So Sinclair viewership actually shrinks in the areas where they've been increasing their national coverage and skewing conservative. Shrinks overall, not surprisingly, in Democratic areas, of which they'll have many if this merger goes through, increases slightly in Trump area, areas that voted for Trump. But the problem is that you'll have a mini cable news model here. So you don't really need necessarily to win. You know, you have 3-4 news stations in an average American market. You can be the third, but if you're getting the 25-30% of the people, 40% or more in some cases, that support President Trump, you can probably support a localized Fox News type operation. And that then will change the entire local political discourse. It's not simply that, you know, some people watch Sinclair, some people won't, although that is true. It's that they'll change the environment of local news gathering.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, they're verging on putting themselves out of business. And I say that because of the fact that if I think about my own consumption patterns, you know, I'm in my 40s. I watch some local news. I don't make a habit of it, but I often turn it on when I know there's something important going on locally. And I'm looking to find out, you know, a little bit more than what I'm going to find out from my local newspaper, which may not be able to update me as quickly. So, you know, it's sort of on the scene kind of things often are sort of important. Sometimes it's weather, right? which is important to people everywhere. And a reduction in that makes that station much less valuable to me. And I think with the rise of on-demand, with the networks creating their own over-the-top streaming services, so that, you know, you can start getting primetime television shows without having to ever watch your local affiliate for all intents and purposes, you know, they're sort of draining the value out of one of the few things that would keep people loyal to their local affiliates. And people still are. That's been my experience, certainly. You know, although, you know, I asked you the question because I do think many young people are fading away from local television news. You know, your local anchors are celebrities. If you bump into them in a supermarket, you know, people will notice, you know, and they do care and they do trust them, right? There's still this sense that a local news program is important and it is a source, an important source, and the people who delivered are trusted. And what I find really strange about this, especially the situation with the anchors being asked to read this statement about fake news, is the timing. Lou, do you have any sense why now? Why when there is this merger, right, that they'd like to pull off, that Sinclair would like to pull off? In some ways, why stoke this fire now? What is up with that? Do you have any sense for that?
You know, Paul, I've actually thought about that, and I can come up with two possible explanations that point in slightly different directions. One is that they thought that by doing this, they would curry favor with the administration and curry favor with Ajit Pai in a way that would actually make the deal go through more smoothly. That seems, to me at least, it seems fairly obvious to be a miscalculation if that was true. And I don't have another explanation for it.
I know.
You know, I mean, the other is just that they're clumsy and tone deaf. Now, you know, they've gotten to be the largest broadcast group in the United States largely by stealth. I mean, and they took over the television station in my hometown, and I need to disclose to your listeners that station was put on the air by my father and, of course, many other people, but he was one of the people who started it. And
You're talking about WICS television in Springfield, Illinois, which I think Sinclair acquired right around 1999 or so, I think.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this was before I even knew about Sinclair. I was a professor at that time. I've studied these things and I knew Sinclair existed, but I would go home to, you know, see my mom and watch Sinclair, and I would go, God, this is really awful television. And I would, local news, and I would hear that from a lot of other people locally. It wasn't simply, you know, it wasn't an ideological question. It's just that they were doing things on the cheap in every possible way. So I was wondering a long time ago, how is this a good business model in a competitive broadcast market? Well, you know, there's two ways to do things in many markets. One is to deliver quality and win more viewers or customers, and the other is to do things as cheaply as you possibly can, squeeze your margins down to the very bottom, and operate on the dirt cheap, and that's their business model. So that still doesn't answer your question. I can't answer that question.
I know. It would seem to me that, you know, they could just put the whole program on pause until they get this deal signed.
Bluntly, it's what I would have done if you've already approached the FCC chair, and clearly there's so much going on, and it's very hard to focus people's attention on broadcast issues. Exactly. And Chris certainly knows this. You know, people don't. You know, to get people to talk about the FCC, you know, other than even when John Oliver did it on net neutrality last year, it was of course a big story because of net neutrality. But for those of us who were on the inside, it was like, wow, I can't believe that this many people even know that the FCC exists at this point, much less are protesting something related to it. So I think there's a similar kind of issue here. They've managed to raise themselves to national visibility, which I don't think was their goal, at least not at this point.
I come down on the side that they're doing everything they can to push this deal through, because we haven't talked about one of the really important aspects of this deal, and that's how much power Sinclair ends up with over political advertising sales in this country after this deal is done. Mm-hmm. That is something that you don't hear a lot of people talking about, but if you're an outside group, even a major political party, and you're going to want to do business going into the midterms, but also the 2020 election, you're going to have to do business with Sinclair. And that's doubly true, maybe even triply true, if they own 71% of the television audience. And there's broadcast as an industry is not in good shape. Let's be honest about it. But there still is some pennies from heaven that rains down on broadcasters, and that's the election cycle, where you have all of the outside spending now. Sinclair is going to be able to set the rates on that. And for issue advertising by outside groups, they're going to be able to promote messages that they favor very cheaply, sell those ads very cheaply to groups that they agree with, and jack up the price on the groups that they don't. And if you want to do business, you're going to have to do business with Sinclair. So I've always believed that the effort to push this through instead of just waiting it out is to get ahead of this, ahead of what's going to be a very aggressive election cycle here in 2018. But certainly, again, in 2020, there's going to be a great deal of political advertising dollars up for grabs. Sinclair wants the Tribune stations to be part of that process.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think Chris is spot on. And I think Sinclair does raises an interesting question, which is, can you engage in discriminatory pricing as a local television station based upon political views?
Yes.
And I think, yeah, you can. And you certainly can probably get away with it under this FCC, whether it's strictly legal or not. That's an argument one could have, but by the time you've had that argument, the election, both the midterms and the 2020 election, will be over. And Sinclair, by the way, has not only its own must carry political editorials, let's call them, but also has wrapped its editorial positions around when a liberal organization ran an issue ad on their station, they basically criticized it as fake news coming out of that ad. So, I mean, they are not even remotely afraid to use their audio, their market power to advance their political viewpoint in any number of ways.
Well, So Lou, what would you say to anyone who hears this and is concerned and is upset? And especially maybe they live in a current Sinclair town, or maybe they live in a Tribune town, though they may not even know whether they live in a Tribune town or not.
Right.
What does your average viewer, your average citizen do?
Well, I think your average citizen can do the things that average citizens can always do, which is, among other things, people don't realize that, I know it sounds almost naive, but it's true that writing, signing petitions, writing, and letting the FCC know that that people out there are watching matters. Talking to your local Congress people really matters a lot, and to your senators. Even if you're in a conservative area, there are conservatives, Chris Ruddy of Newsmax, Glenn Beck even, have criticized this deal, I think partly because they're afraid of the competition. But even so, it's important to let your local, you know, representatives, your congressional representatives and your senators know that you believe that this deal is anti-competitive, first of all, that it gives too much power to one company. And even if you're not certain about that, that the way that this has been done is a kind of a questionable backroom deal to benefit one company only, that it shouldn't, nothing should happen until all that's been exposed to the light of day. So I think people should let their representatives know. They should make noise in the media. They should let their friends know through social media that this is an issue that's going to affect them. And if you care about essentially any other issue in the United States, you ought to care about this issue, because this kind of concentrated media power is the gatekeeper for essentially every other issue that flows through the public space of the United States.
So we're going to change gears, but we're going to stay with ownership here, but we're going to look at radio. And, you know, we do talk about radio here, Radio Survivor, but radio ownership isn't often talked about because there haven't been a lot of changes in radio ownership in the last decade plus. So much was wrought by the 1996 Telecommunications Act that we're still dealing with the outcomes there. But that hasn't stopped the fact that there are many in the broadcast industry who would like to see ownership regulations loosened even more. And I know that the issue came up recently at the National Association of Broadcasters conference there in Las Vegas. Chris Terry, what I heard was that the Chairman Pai has signaled his intention to see the local ownership limits, the caps on how many stations that may be co-owned in a given market, could be lifted or eliminated. Is that what you're hearing, Chris?
Yeah, the proposal that I've seen that's being circulated is an older one that essentially, right now the rule is that in the largest radio markets, you can own up to 8 radio stations commonly. And there's been some efforts in the past to raise that limit. But I think the reason you're hearing noise about this right now is that in the FCC's order last year, which we talked about earlier in this program and have talked about on other appearances, is that the FCC notably left local radio ownership entirely the same. That as it was changing essentially all of these other media ownership rules, many of which have been standing, some of which have been in effect since 1975, the FCC said that it didn't believe it needed to do anything on local radio ownership rule. And of course, the NAB, as the head lobby group, which represents many, many radio owners, they sort of felt slighted by that. And I think what you're hearing now is now that the organization members are together, there's some push on the FCC to do it. The proposal that's being talked about is only being talked about at the industry level. Pai signaled some sort of support for it, but there's been nothing official from the FCC on that proceeding so far.
And I understand that the industry itself, the commercial radio industry, is not necessarily unified on it, and that, in fact, at this moment, iHeart Radio, the former Clear Channel, the largest radio owner in the country, would kind of like things to stay put while it undergoes bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, I think you can easily see where they're coming from on that one. They're having enough financial problems right now without a need to compete in the way that they did in the mid-90s with buying up stations. I assume, I'm going to make an assumption, having worked at Clear Channel and seen how deals were made back then, that if Clear Channel had surplus cash, they would be all in favor, iHeartMedia would be all in favor of pushing this forward, because they lack the ability to acquire new stations right now. They don't necessarily want the situation to change. iHeartMedia is still a dominant player in radio. They're still the largest single owner, not quite as powerful as they were at the height of the Clear Channel days, but still dominant. If the rules were to change, there's markets where competitors might be able to buy up some stations and then give iHeartMedia an even tougher run for its money. That's certainly something iHeartMedia doesn't need as it's trying to sort out its bankruptcy proceedings right now.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll keep our eyes on it. That just crossed my transom today before we went to record this episode. So I thought I'd drop into that. And I also wonder, is there anything new about net neutrality? I know that there's many challenges to the FCC's revision, so to speak, of net neutrality rules or the abolishment of them. I guess things right now are probably just winding their way through the legal process.
That's correct. The case was bounced out to the Ninth Circuit for a little bit, but is back in the D.C. Circuit. The most notable recent development on the entire net neutrality issue is that the FCC was asked for and was granted yet another delay in response to the case that's in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in U.S. Telecom v. FCC. That was a challenge to the net neutrality rules that were passed by Tom Wheeler's commission in 2015 and are currently being appealed by U.S. Telecom. They had been upheld by the D.C. Circuit twice on review. Case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But on the same day that PI announced the changes that the commission voted on in December, they also went over to the Supreme Court and asked them for a delay in the U.S. Telecom case. And there appears to be no legitimate reason why the commission continues to delay, but the delay that they asked for and were granted on April 6th is actually the sixth delay in response to that case. And they're deliberately holding up the Supreme Court's review in U.S. Telecom in the meantime.
So, Professor Lou Friedland, as I kind of put these three topics together here kind of quickly, because I think they bear consideration as together, right? That these are not necessarily separate issues. These are not things that happen in isolation. The regulation of the internet and the dismantling of network neutrality, ownership of your local television stations, and the ability to have a significant nationwide market power there, as well as the ownership regulation of radio, where we've already seen what overwhelming market power has done to our local radio dials. If there's a change, and then there with a possible change, what does this all add up to? What's going on here? And what is the threat here, sort of to American democratic discourse that we're looking at right here? What are the threats that we're really looking at?
Well, I believe that while clearly more and more people are getting more and more news via the internet, via social media, from their friends on Facebook and so on, any number of studies have shown that the source of that news, especially local news, is still primarily local newspapers, but to a secondary extent, local television stations. And so if you want even the most basic news about democracy, and we have a tradition, again, of localism in the United States, people do, that's where they act. That's where they can find their public officials. When people start to get active, can't always influence your senator, but you can, in fact, find your city council person or your board of education member and get engaged. And I think that all of this together means that we're going to have a shrinking of the total amount of coverage of local communication, local issues. And I think that we're also seeing a shifting, as we've discussed in this podcast, a shifting to the right, both in radio and now in local television. And I think that these things don't bode well for the kind of democratic communication ecology that we need to govern ourselves.
And, you know, you mentioned how when people are specifically dealing with local news and issues, how they're turning to their local newspapers online, they're turning to their local television stations online. Do you have a sense for how network neutrality, or rather the loss of network neutrality, might reinforce those patterns? Do you think it provides additional friction in the system towards the development of local online news services, or is the jury still a little bit out on that as we probably see how local ISPs and or large ISPs like Comcast are likely holding putting pause on any moves they might make? You know, do you have any sense for how these things might intermingle, or do we just still need to kind of watch?
Well, I think the short answer is that we need to watch. The first effects of a repeal of net neutrality are more likely to be in terms of charges that people see in their various kinds of broadband consumption. But could that trickle down, for example, to make it more difficult for a competitor to a local newspaper to get started, as has happened in a number of places around the country? Online competitors to local newspapers depend upon free entry to the internet and relatively inexpensive access. I think it could have a chilling effect on the next form of local news, which is certainly likely to be online. But that's speculative, I admit. I think that the economics of local news are pretty difficult, even without a repeal of net neutrality, and I think that a repeal of net neutrality just makes it even tougher for new entrants.
Professor Lewis Friedland, you're a professor of journalism and mass communication and director of the Center for Communication Democracy at the University of Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Survivor.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Terry, you're a professor of journalism and media law at the University of Minnesota. Thank you very much for joining us again.
Always glad to be here.
Thank you to my co-host, Paul Rees-Mandel, for that interview with Christopher Terry and Lewis Friedland. I appreciate the deep dive. I appreciate digging into the weeds. You've been listening to Radio Survivor. We're online at radiosurvivor.com. And you could subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Eric Klein. Thank you for listening.